Well, good morning, church. So I read a story a few years ago, and this is a true story of a guy who set the Guinness Book of World Records back in September of 2005. His name's Suresh Joachim, and it was who could watch TV for the longest consecutive time. And he set the Guinness Book of World Records with 69 consecutive hours and 48 minutes. He would only take like a 5-minute break every hour and 15-minute break every 8 hours. And for 70 hours, he sat in front of a TV screen with his eyes on the screen the entire time. Now, I'm pretty sure during this whole COVID-19 mess, that record has been challenged several times. But how do you go about deciding to try to break that record? So we're returning to our series, Sinning Like a Christian, on the 7 deadly sins, mainly because I wanted to talk about this particular vice. This is the vice of sloth that we're going to be talking about today. And if you want to tune out when you hear that, please, you may be exactly the person I'm trying to talk to. Because think about this. What a weird sin to be on the list of the 7 deadliest sins, of the things that could kill your soul and destroy your life. I mean, if you were to come up with a list of the worst sins, what would you put on it? Murder? Adultery? Listening to Nickelback? I mean, what would you say is the worst sin? And you've got to, if you're not a Christian and you're just tuning in, you've got a question of faith that says sloth is somehow worse than murder, right? I used to think that sloth was not a sin that I struggle with because I'm more of a workaholic. I love my job. I find a lot of meaning and purpose in it. I love what I get to do. So I never thought sloth was something I struggled with until I realized what it actually is. And then I realized I don't know if I struggle with anything more than I do this. If you grew up in church, whenever you hear sloth, you probably think of words like sluggard and some of those very vivid descriptions in the Proverbs about sluggards. There's this one verse in Proverbs 19 that has a fascinating way of describing it. Look at this in Proverbs 19:24. A sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He will not even bring it back to his mouth. Okay, so I want to do something and show you what this would be like. So this is what a sluggard is. This is somebody who's got sloth, right? They're so lazy. This is such a vivid word picture. This is somebody who's so lazy that they're laying here and they've got chips and dip. And they're like, man, that looks good. White cheese dip. It looks so good, but I just don't have the energy to bring it back to the mouth. But I am not a sluggard, so. Or what about this next one? In Proverbs 26, in verse 14, it says, as a door turns on its hinges, so a sluggard turns on its bed. I love that way of describing it. This is someone who's so lazy, they're so filled with apathy, they just stay in bed. These are Willy Wonka's grandparents, right? I mean, the guy wins a chance to win a chocolate factory, and only one of those grandparents get out of bed. That's what we think of when we think of sloth, right? But there's so much more. Actually, it's in the Proverbs too. We just missed it. Look at what's in the verse right before that, in verse 13 of chapter 26. A sluggard says, there's a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming the streets. What does that have to do with being a sluggard? Well, you see what's happening is they're imagining trouble ahead. They're saying there could be a lion. There could be something that's going to attack us. They've imagined all sorts of horrible things that could happen to them. Apparently, the Proverbs were written in a year like 2020. These are people who don't want to do anything because there's a possibility of something going wrong or of something getting hurt. These are people who have great anxiety about the future, and so they don't do anything. They're too afraid of all the things that could go wrong to put themselves out there. The sluggard has learned a kind of cynicism that keeps them safe, but it also keeps them inept, keeps them from doing anything. It keeps them safe, but it keeps them in their bed. Or what about this in Proverbs 26:16? A sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven people who answer discreetly. They're wiser in their own eye. Sometimes people who are trapped in sloth and they're trapped in it because their ego is inflated. The actual Hebrew for wiser in their own eyes is too big for their britches. They think too much about their opinion. And you've probably seen this. Sometimes when people start a job and an entry-level position, they want to have the corner office, and they don't want to do any work that seems beneath them. When I'm trying to mentor some young preachers, I always tell them, reach for the broom before you reach for the mic. There's no work that's beneath you. And that's kind of what the proverb is getting at. These people that feel like, it's just not up to my standards. But no one starts off in the corner office, right? Or what about this? In Proverbs 21, verses 25 through 26, here's what it said. The craving of a sluggard will be the death of him, because his hands refuse to work. All day long he craves for more, but the righteous give without sparing. The thing that kills the slothful person here isn't laziness, it's their craving. In fact, they're lazy because they're craving something else, something more. A lot of us, when we think about sloth, we think about rest, but true sloth isn't rest. You know, when you think about lounging around all weekend or taking a Saturday and just relaxing, that's not sloth. In fact, that's almost the opposite of it. For a lot of us, the only two categories we have in life is work and being lazy. But that's not true. For some of us watching, the most spiritual thing we could do is take a nap, to work less and to rest more. Sloth isn't resting. It's not even laziness. It's actually so much more than that. Okay, so what is sloth? It is saying no to the life you actually have. It is saying no to the life you've been given by God and the endless possibilities that are ahead of you. I mean, think about this. God made you. No matter if you believe that or don't believe it, God, every breath you take is God's way of saying yes to you and your life. And the talents that you have, no matter what they are, even if you're not a Christian, there's a common grace. God has given you talents for the rest of the people around you, for your neighborhood, for your family, for your community. And those gifts were given to you for a reason bigger than you. And God is calling all of us to be awake to this good world and to contribute to it. And you know what? Sometimes the sluggard is right. Sometimes there is a lion in the road up ahead. You never have to worry about things going wrong, because they will always, in some way or another, go wrong. But there are still good reasons to do what you've been called to do anyway. And since this is a sin that isn't really on a lot of our radar, I want to show you a Bible story that is. And it's a Bible story that if you grew up in church, you're familiar with, but you have probably never heard it used to explain this sin. So it's in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is going to reveal to his disciples who he really is and why he really came to this earth. And in Matthew chapter 16, starting in verse 21, He is talking to his disciples, and he begins to explain to them that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. And Peter, one of his disciples, took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said, "this shall never happen to you." And Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." And then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world and forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done." So Jesus is talking to his disciples and he's explaining to them that he is going to go to Jerusalem, the religious capital of their world, and he is going to take on the powers that run that city. He's going to take on a system that is corrupt, filled with money changers and self-righteous high priests, and he's going to confront the religious leaders of Israel who were called to be a light to the Gentiles, but have now set up the temple in a way to exclude them. And he's going to call them out for their hypocrisy and their greed and their racism and their self-righteous morality. And he's going to call them things like, you whitewashed tomb and you sons of hell and you brood of vipers, and they don't like that. And so he's telling them that there's going to be a cost to that. He starts to tell them, I'm going to suffer. I am going to die. And Peter, who is one of the more caffeinated disciples, comes up and says to Jesus, stop talking like that. You're the Messiah, and Messiahs don't die on crosses. And Jesus looks at Peter and says, get behind me, Satan. And you know it's a bad day when Jesus calls you Satan. I heard one preacher point out that what's happening here is Jesus is telling his disciples, I am going to give myself fully to the healing of the world. I'm going to lay down my life to resisting the way things are. He is going to die to the sins of the world. He's going to take it all on him. And there is a cost to this. And Jesus knows the cost to it. There's a cost to this kind of action. And he is telling the disciples just what that cost is. Have you ever noticed whenever you feel called or compelled to do something, there's always a cost. Whenever there's some kind of action that you feel like you are uniquely gifted to do and you know in your bones it's the right thing to do. Have you ever noticed when you felt called to do something? And I'm not just talking about church, Jesus, spiritual stuff. I'm talking about things like being a good parent or being, you know, starting a thing in your neighbor. I'm talking about a calling that's bigger than yourself. Have you ever noticed that when you go to do something like that, there's always a cost? Sometimes it's a physical cost. Sometimes there's a relational cost. Some of you have gone through criticism because of some good work that you knew you were called to do. And it may have bruised you and it may have wounded you, but in your bones, you knew it was worth it. Sloth says it isn't. That's the best definition of sloth that I know. It's the lie that nothing is worth your sacrifice. Nothing is worth laying down your life. So you might as well just lay down with your life. You know, I think it's interesting that of the seven deadly sins that Christians have historically said, these are the ones that can kill your life and destroy your soul, that many of those were seen as bad things in the Greco-Roman world where Paul was planting these churches. Like, you know, greed and envy and vanity, those kind of things. Vanity, not so much. But the one that was just totally foreign to the Greco-Roman world was this one, sloth. Sloth is a uniquely Christian sin because underneath it, there is this assumption that God is going to judge each person's life and what we did with our life. We will be held accountable for God. It would be revealed. By the way, this is why there's such a thing as the Protestant work ethic. Because a group of Christians believe that what they did with their life, not just what they did on Sunday, they would somehow be accountable to God for. But the Christian definition of sloth does not just mean, so work really hard. In fact, by working really hard, you might actually be giving in to sloth. A lot of workaholics can be in the vice of sloth because we can use the hard work at the office to avoid the hard work of life. Let me explain. So back in the 4th century, when the Emperor Constantine demanded that everyone in the Roman Empire convert to Christianity, what that immediately meant is that a ton of people were Christian in name and not reality. Where everyone is a Christian, no one is a Christian. And so there was a group of Christian monks who decided that they were tired of watching the bar for following Jesus get lower and lower. So they moved out to the wilderness to try to follow Jesus more seriously. They were trying to get away from all the temptation and sin, but when they moved out to the wilderness, they realized they brought all that with them. And after a few years, they started talking about what it was like doing hard work of the soul. And one of those monks, a guy named Evagrius, actually wrote about sloth. And he wrote about it, he called it the noonday demon. And he called it that because he said it seems to strike right in the middle of the day when it's the hottest, when life is the most difficult, and that's when I would start questioning the kind of life choices that I have made. He says the demon drives the monk, the noonday demon drives the monk to desire other places where he could more easily obtain life's necessities, more readily find work, and make a real success of himself. The demon suggests that after all, it's not the place that's the basis for pleasing the Lord. God is adored everywhere. And then he brings to mind the people that you have left behind that you love. I remember a couple of years ago, I realized that this was the major vice I struggled with when I read that quote. That particular quote did it for me because I realized sloth is not just a form of laziness. It's also a form of restlessness. Okay, so this is really embarrassing to share with you, but I think it's going to be helpful, so I'm willing to. As long as I have been in ministry, so like almost 20 years now, I have got to work at three wonderful churches. Four in total, but three. No, just kidding. I've only worked at three churches. Three wonderful churches. And all throughout those years, I have caught myself daydreaming about working at other churches. I mean, a couple of times a month, I'll think about living somewhere else and, you know, working with a different group of people and or even doing a different kind of job. And I always compare the worst parts of the job I currently have to the best parts, I think, of the job I would have. I in my mind, and I know this is crazy because I love my job. I'll say things like, you know what? There the people will love me. You know, there I won't have those conversations or get those emails or take those phone calls. You know, there people will send me more encouragement cards or gift cards or other passive-aggressive things I could say. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not being passive-aggressive at all. I'm trying to say I love working at PV. I love my job, which makes this so ludicrous. But I'm being honest about it. You guys have been so good to me. Y'all have been so great to me and my family. I am not trying to say anything but that. I'm trying to tell you how ludicrous this demon is. Because what I do in those moments is I start thinking, those people over there at that new church, these people, they don't know how lucky they have it. But those people over there, they would. Now, I know that's ridiculous. But it's outlandish, and it's also really common. What I've started to notice about when that vice tends to strike me the most, it's also the times that I'm working the most. The main time that this sin attacks me, if I'm being honest, is when there's some tension in a relationship that needs to be dealt with, but I don't want to deal with it. Some kind of conflict that needs to be had, and I don't want to do it. Or some misunderstanding that needs to be cleared up, and I don't want to do that. Instead, I'll write emails, or I'll write a new sermon, or I'll daydream about a new job where everyone is perfect. I'd rather do those things because the work that's waiting for me, that I've been called to, is harder work. This is why I believe more marriages have been ruined by sloth than by lust. More bad marriages have been entered into because of sloth than lust. This is why so many people leave one church to go to another and they say it's about doctrine or, you know, the precise wording of, you know, this particular debatable matter, but often it's sloth. It's there those people will be better. Sloth is so much more than laziness. It's the cynical dismissal of the life we already have. It promises things would be better if you just had another spouse, or things would be better if you're single and you were just married. It promises things would be better at that different church and you wouldn't have to deal with those people or those leaders and all these different things. It's the cynical dismissal of the community, the friendships, the relationships, the life we already have. And what happens? We start living in another time zone. We start living in a future. We start living in an imaginary world of movies and books and dreading the life that we actually have sitting before us and unable to see it as it really is, which is a pure gift from God. There's this philosopher named Rebecca DeYoung who actually wrote a great book on the seven deadly sins called Glittering Vices, and I highly recommend it. But Rebecca DeYoung has this quote I want to read to you because I think it defines sloth. She says, "Sometimes marriage or friendships feel euphoric and energizing. Other times they're tedious and empty and full of routines or just plain work. The point is, being committed to any love relationship takes daily nurturing, daily effort, and daily practices that build it up. Neglecting those will slowly break the relationship down. Married love is eternal, but it's also daily, and it's about as daily and unromantic as housekeeping. It is through daily practices and disciplines, whether we feel like doing them or not, that the decision to love is renewed and refreshed and the commitment of love is kept alive. The slothful person in this sense is one who resists the effort of doing day after day whatever it takes to keep the bonds of love strong and living and healthy, whether he or she feels particularly inspired about doing it or not. Sloth is the avoidance of hard work. But it's probably not the hard work we think it is. It's going to the office because you don't want to have that hard conversation at home." In fact, one guy named Jeff Cook says that sloth, one of the biggest symptoms of it is zeal or over too much excitement over petty things. And I know that might be hard to see in the mirror, but see if this rings true. We care way more about our favorite sports team than maybe we do investing in our marriage or in those friendships. We care way more about those shoes and getting the right look than we do about parenting. It's being obsessed over small things. We care way more about that very particular hotly debatable thing than we do about the center of the gospel. And so we move from one congregation to another congregation to another. Sloth is zeal over petty matters. It's a kind of sadness about goodness. It finds the very things we were made to enjoy and pursue to be useless and boring. Sloth tells us when we're in its grip that the good life is dull. I'm starting to believe that so much of what we call doubt is actually a camouflage version of sloth. Because doubt is part of faith. The opposite of doubt the opposite of faith isn't doubt, it's certainty. Doubt is very much a part of faith. But there's two kinds of doubt. There's, is it true? And those are great questions to ask. I love having conversations with people who are asking the is it true question. But there's a second kind of question, and it hides behind the first. It's not is it true, it's is it worth it? And so often, so many of don't like the answer to the second question, so we say we're asking the first. Because let's be honest, the way of Jesus is not for everyone. Jesus was really clear on that. There is a cost to following him, and maybe for you it's not worth it, but before you walk away, make sure you know what you're walking away from. Because real faith, the real Christian faith, asks us to engage life with God, and there comes a point in every disciple's life where they have to weigh the cost of discipleship. And I think what so many of us call cynicism is really sloth. The German word for cynicism is protecting yourself from the pain of life. I'm starting to believe the opposite of sloth isn't working hard. The opposite of sloth, get this church, is joy. The opposite of sloth is joy. And it's the kind of joy that isn't propped up chemically or you have to drink to get it. It's not the kind of joy that's constant entertainment to numb you out. It's the kind of joy that looks at the life you have, the relationships you have, the responsibilities you've been given and says, yes, I can do those well. I will be where I am at and nowhere else. This is the joy of life that says here and now is good and worthwhile, and it's what I'm called to do even if it's hard. One of my favorite lines in any story is in The Lord of the Rings, where the two central characters that are hobbits, Frodo and Sam, they're taking back this evil power that is a ring. They're taking it to Mount Mordor where it can be destroyed. And there's all kinds of villains and treachery and evil on the way trying to kill these two little hobbits. And at one point, Frodo, the main hero, can't go on anymore. And he's in so much despair. And one of the best characters in any story ever written, Sam, says to Frodo, he goes, "Mr. Frodo, there's one thing I know. There is good in this world, and it's worth fighting for." Amen. So this week, we laid to rest Miss Janie Butler. Miss Janie was 99 years young when she passed away, and she lived every day of her life. As talking to Miss Janie over the past couple of years, she lived through the Great Depression, through World War II. She had plenty of hard times in her life, but if you were to describe Miss Janie with one word, it would be joy. At her funeral this week, the whole group of people celebrated, and the reason we celebrated is because she mostly wrote her own obituary, and she demanded that we did, because her life was a gift from God, and what she did with her life was a gift, what was her gift back to God, back to her family, back to her faith community, and to the entire city of Little Rock and the state of Arkansas. This is what the Holy Spirit can do in us. When we renounce the vice of sloth, the despair, the cynicism, and we see, yes, it is worth it. This is what it looks like. The opposite of sloth isn't just going to work. In fact, a lot of workaholism is just rooted in this vice. It's avoiding the hard work that is your life, your relationships, your family. Let the Holy Spirit change us in this regard. Live, be fully alive, and see the good that God is calling you to in your life, because there is good in this world, church, and it's worth fighting for.